What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Well, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary's Tack Theratrix.
I am Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison?
I have a Fredita!
Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior.
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault.
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you very much. We know you have a million options out there and we appreciate it. We couldn't do it without the support of our sponsors. We've got a new one this week, Daddy Butter. Hey, listen, it's a cool company with a funny name, all right? If you need hair care products, which obviously I don't, lotions, soaps, essential oils, things like that, go check out Daddy Butter. They're really nice. They sent me a box of stuff. My wife and daughter love it. If you've got somebody in your life, we're getting close to Christmas and holidays. If you are looking for presents for a particular lady in your life and you've given her the same thing over and over again, well, guess what? I got a new option for you. Go to daddybutter.com. Free shipping on orders over $150. Look, it's a small business. It's a small business and we're trying to support that. That's a good thing. They're based in Connecticut. They seem like really good dudes. I love being involved with companies that are small and starting up. We'll get in early with them. They can get in early with us and we'll support each other. So go ahead and just go take a look at their website. See if there's anything on there that you like. Daddybutter.com. All right. Well, I'll tell you, with all the insanity that we've had this week, with the election, and this is being recorded on November 6th. So it'll be released a little bit later. And by then, everything will be fixed, right? Well, we've got Steve Poikin in here from Slow News Day Show. And he and I got together a couple weeks ago on his show. He's on my show. Steve, what's going on? How are you, man?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, Charlie. I'll say one thing about the election and or at least what will happen in a couple of weeks by the time this airs. The election started out fixed, so it can only get more fixed. I don't know. I think that we've witnessed a progression in just how illegitimate our electoral system is, and I don't for the life of me know how there are people walking around ambulatory who think that they have witnessed reality in terms of people are acting like this is a decisive victory.
Yeah.
For Joe Biden, who, as far as I can tell, hasn't even won by a full percentage point yet, which is supposed to trigger an automatic recount. I don't know if we'll see that. I think Trump will have to sue multiple states And even still, depending on how, you know, the political persuasion of that state's governor or that state's secretary of state or their board of elections individuals, it looks like we're witnessing a broad daylight theft once again.
Well, when they say that Joe Biden is this is a successful election for him, I think what they mean is that he lived to see it, right? That's the barometer by which we are measuring success with the Biden campaign. I just have a hard time, with the eyeball test, which is I saw the crowds or lack thereof for the Biden rallies, and this guy got more votes than Barack Obama, who was like selling out stadiums. I mean, say what you want about Obama. He was like Bob fucking Dylan out there. You know, I mean, the places were packed. People were going crazy for him. He was a rock star. And Joe Biden is none of those things. I mean, he might, you know, he's been in it for a while and people know who he is. And I even asked my mom, like, She's not a Trump fan. She's not a Biden fan, but she voted for Biden just because he wasn't Trump. Her words were, I would have voted for the dog catcher, you know, over Trump. And I get that. There's a certain percentage of people that would vote for an inanimate object over Donald Trump. And maybe a case could be made that Joe Biden is one of those inanimate objects. But 73 million people felt that way, and they didn't bother to show up at his rally. I mean, the people that were voting for Trump knew they were voting for Trump, and they still went to his rally. So it's not like, you know, I buy the argument, well, they knew who they were voting for, so they didn't go to the Biden rallies. Well, yeah, but that the point is to get other people to come to your side and by showing enthusiasm. There was nothing. So what, this guy all of a sudden set the record? I mean, come on, I'm just calling bullshit. Just on the eyeball, I don't know. I mean, I know there's cheating, and I know there's a lot of, you know, it's hard to quantify how people feel about this stuff, but come on, he couldn't sell out a drive-in, you know?
No, he couldn't sell out a Montessori school classroom.
No.
If he wanted to. Mm-hmm. With U.S. elections, and I've been, you know, I've been keeping an eye on this for 25 years or so now. I actually worked on a political campaign before I was legally old enough to vote. I've been on the inside of this for 25 years ish. Nobody was excited about Joe Biden. Not even the people who were excited about beating Trump were excited for Joe Biden. And Kamala Harris is even less exciting than Joe Biden. That dead-eyed, soulless servant to power is going to be our president. Joe Biden's not making it a full term. There's no way. So we're seeing the culmination of, you know, years of grooming for Kamala Harris. And basically an internal kind of coup where the people who run the DNC and the people who run the Democratic Party and the donor support network that they have wanted Kamala Harris. They threw a big party for her in the Hamptons. It was basically her pre-coronation deal. And she couldn't even place in the top three or four in her home state as a primary presidential candidate because we knew her. We knew who she was, and we didn't want her anywhere near the White House, even if we largely agree that the presidency is a caretaker position and a public relations position instead of the most powerful person on the planet. The idea that 72 million people came out and voted for a Biden-Harris ticket, shattering records, I think speaks to the hubris that this part of the duopoly walks around with every day, because they think people are going to believe that. And I haven't talked to very many people who, even if they went for Biden, believe that this was a legitimate election. Yeah. You know what I mean? I mean, it's like there, of course, all of the you know, Chatterati and fucking Blue Check and the very online community is being paid to push a narrative that Joe Biden is the most, you know, record-setting president, and it was because he represents a return to normal. Yeah. And I'm not buying it. What Biden represents is a return to the exact conditions in America that gave us Donald Trump in the first place.
You got it, man. That's exactly right. It's like, this is, how many times do we have to play this game before we realize that we're, you know, I think Jimmy Dore puts that best, that, you know, that Trump is a symptom, you know, that this is when you run a guy like Obama who is, you know, the media just embraces him and they make up tons of excuses for him. They don't call him out on his bullshit. They don't call him out on the Flint water drinking stunt. And they claim that the only, you know, controversy he had in his 8 years was that he wore a tan suit one time to a press conference and all this stuff. And it's like, we're not stupid. All right. We understand this is my writing partner, Jeff Berwick, said, he called him you know, Barack drone bomber, because that's what he was. You know, he's a drone bombing killer who's on the record saying, turns out I'm good at killing people. And you get all of this. And then what do we have? That's the transition from that into Trump. And we go through 4 years of Trump where the left pulls their hair out and they freak out and they say, oh, this is the worst thing that's ever happened to us. And then what do? We bring back a repeat of the Obama administration because what? It's a return to normalcy. Well, is that what we want? This is expanding wars, and I think that the problem is the vast majority of people are not educated on this. They don't really know Obama. They just think, well, he didn't embarrass us internationally when he would go to various countries.
He got caught spying on allies. He got caught spying on Angela Merkel, for Christ's sake. Like, that's not an Cablegate. That's not an embarrassment. Collateral murder. That's not an embarrassment. Fast and Furious. No. None of these things are bailing out the fucking bankers on the backs of the poor, kicking 5.8 million people out of their home while he was on his way out the door. Yeah. That's not an embarrassment. Like, it's either collective amnesia, intentional stupidity, a little bit of both, or just abject fucking ignorance. I'm sorry. Can I swear on your show? I didn't ask.
Oh, it's encouraged. Okay. Actually. Yeah. Yeah. We prefer that. Yeah. And to point it out to somebody that was an Obama fan, they look at you like you have three heads, like that you're telling them something that they've never heard before. That, like, what? How dare you? How dare you tarnish this man's reputation? It's like, I'm just
by reading out loud what his record is, you know. Yeah. Yeah. We're at the point now to where if you went to your local coffee shop and you brought your laptop and you opened it up and you pulled up the CIA's own website and started reading out loud what the CIA themselves have declassified and put it up on their website, half or more of the people in that coffee shop would call you a tinfoil nutter. And you can be like, look, but it's right here. No, I'm not. You know, it just, they would rather not know and keep going, because being incurious is somehow equal to being safe, I think.
Yeah,
I haven't figured that. I'm not an incurious person, so I haven't really actually figured that. I'm speculating wildly.
I mean, I'm probably like you in that I'm objective to the insanity of both sides. I'm not here to pretend that one side is necessarily better than the other. But I have found myself in the unenviable position of defending Donald Trump more and more lately. Not because I like the guy, I don't, but because the attacks from the left are so unhinged and the media is so dishonest in there that I find I have to stand up and just say, those are all lies. How dare you do that? And like, I'm defending Trump behind me saying, stop the bullshit. And I don't ever want to be in that position. But it's like, They're making me do it. They're making me do it by with their dishonesty. And I just look, Orange Man bad. I get it. You guys don't like the guy. I didn't like the guy before he became president. I've got a list of problems with the guy. I don't like that personality. I don't like people like that. I would never want to be friends with somebody like that. But my God, I've never seen somebody be so targeted by the media. And I get it. You become president and you put a big target on yourself. You ask for that job, you're gonna get hatred and everything. But the media is so dishonest and they just can't, like, I always felt like there's enough legitimate stuff about Trump that he's done in the past, or, you know, that you don't need to make up stuff about him. Why would you be making up things? But they can't help themselves, you know? It's just
if they legitimately criticize Donald Trump. Over the many, many, many things you can legitimately criticize Trump over, they would have to either add that Donald Trump's agenda would have been impossible to pass without the help of the Senate Democrats and the House Democrats. And they would have to, like, kind of gather them all together for that. You know, the fact that Trump ran on, we're getting out of these wars. And then he gets into office and he goes, okay, I would like to, you know, have a troop withdrawal from Syria. We don't need to be in Syria. All of a sudden it was false flag season. And the Democrats would not let him pull out of Syria, wouldn't let him pull out of Afghanistan or Iraq or Somalia. We've been ramping up our military presence in Africa over the last decade to the point to where the entire continent is basically just a series of proxy wars between us and China. And nobody talks about that. And if the media were to whisper it, they would have to include the fact that Democrats are just as much to blame for enabling Trump in all of this, or going around his back to make sure that we have these forever wars. And that's not a track that they want to take, because it's in their best interest financially and for access to act like Democrats good, Orange Man bad. Chuck Schumer, even though he helped fast track over 100 of Trump's judicial appointments, he's the resistance, because he went home and campaigned on what a horrible person Donald Trump was while making sure that his agenda was passed. It's critical thinking, you know, paying attention to what Republicans do and Democrats do. That's for idiots like us, Charlie. That's not for, you know, the big brains at MSNBC or CNN or Fox, for that matter.
Yeah. Yeah. Nancy Pelosi goes on and talks about what a danger Donald Trump is. Okay. And look, she might have a point. Look, it could be, yeah, he's a narcissist and a, you know, he's got personality traits that I don't appreciate. And he, okay, all those things, let's just say Nancy Pelosi's correct. He's a dangerous man. Why did you authorize him? Why did you sign off on his enhanced military budget? If he's so dangerous, well, he's a danger, but it's okay that we give, you know, an extra couple hundred billion dollars to the military. Oh, really? Well, if you're so concerned about, you're going to give the most dangerous man in the world an extra $150 billion to go play with the military, either you're stupid or you're lying or you're in on it, you know? So it's hard to even take these people seriously. It's hard to tell where the political theater starts and stops, because I know that in the past, the left and the right would fight with each other and then they'd all be on the golf course in La Quinta. You know what I mean? Like when Congress was out of session. I don't know now. I mean, I think they might actually really despise Trump, you know, probably because he's called them out. But they still play ball when it comes to the things that are you know, sacred cows, like increasing military spending, continuing to give foreign aid to Israel, things like, oh, they're fucking on board with him. Like, oh yeah, we're big fans of what he's doing. Of course. So they're such hypocrites.
Yeah, I mean, and let's, you know, let's try and put it into a little bit of a perspective too. You don't get to be a member of Congress unless you pretend that the national security state doesn't exist, or if you acknowledge their existence, it's to uplift them and make sure that they are as supported as humanly possible. When it comes to screwing over workers, like, it, and that's really ultimately, like, the biggest problem that I've always had with Trump before he became a war criminal was the fact that he wouldn't pay his contractors. He would stiff
me
his
too.
Contractors. I'm a carpenter by trade.
I'm in the real estate in construction business too. So when I saw, I thought, what a shitty thing to do. You do that. That's a developer mentality when they can be such dickheads sometimes where they stiff the lowest guy in the totem pole. Make him sue me. You know?
Yeah. I hate that. I'm going to make this guy that I wouldn't pay, you know, what I was contractually obligated to pay him. I'm going to make that guy go spend more of his money on a lawyer. And then I'm going to bury this fuck with a dozen of my lawyers until he goes away. Problem solved. But now you've got, you know, and this is why I've never understood why the working class supported Trump as hard as the working class did. Like, all you have to do is look at the amount of lawsuits he's had by contractors to know that this guy doesn't give a fuck about you. But at the same token, neither does Nancy Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi's husband is responsible for a number of workers not getting paid in the exact same style, in the exact same format as Trump. These are horrible fucking shit demons. They really are. And the fact that I have a theory that in an increasingly secular American society, the same energy that we would put into a supernatural belief system or system of faith, we've transferred over into political identity. And we have seen the deification of politicians of all fucking people, to the point to where, Nancy Pelosi or AOC or Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump or Rand Paul are like lionized as these demigods who can do no wrong and who will save them. And then you look at their records and you're like, oh, this is a continuation of the agenda that George H.W. Bush set forth in the early 80s. And all we've got out of lionizing politicians is more wars, more money in the pockets of the richest Americans. None of it's trickled down to us. Largely giant portions of the planet are fucked. Now, I'm not like a climate change alarmist or anything, but I recognize that when you dump poison into the water, it's bad for the water. And when you dump poison into the sky, it's bad for the sky. Like that it shouldn't take a qualification, Charlie, to say that, you know. Right. It shouldn't. But because of the way that science and particularly climate science has been weaponized politically and employed that way, you kind of have to.
Yeah.
I also don't think that any climate data that we get that doesn't incorporate geoengineering is incomplete data and we shouldn't trust it.
Of course. Yeah, of course. Well, I wonder now, so your work, like you've been doing exceptional work on the Julian Assange component. Now, I've been hearing a lot of things like on Twitter lately saying, and this is, of course, wishful thinking, I would imagine, but I'm curious to get your take on this. Let's say Trump officially loses. He's on his way out. He's got 8 weeks or so to wrap things up. Pardon Assange? Does it happen? Could it happen?
I mean, look, man, any moment of any given day, it's possible for Donald Trump to pardon Julian Assange. Is he going to? I doubt it. I really do. What we've seen with Trump is that even if he wants something to happen, unless it falls in line with what the deep state wants, with what the people who run the money behind the RNC want, it doesn't happen. So either Trump is a president without power, or he's a president with power, but he's elected to not use it over and over and over and over and over again. And neither way does that bode well for Donald Trump. I wish that I could be more confident about that. And I know that nothing would piss off the national security state or the Democrats more than a pardon for Julian Assange. And it's possible that Donald Trump can be convinced to, like, spite fuck him one last time. But I being on the inside of this situation for as long as I have now, I honestly believe that the solution to this has to come from a overwhelming numbers in the streets, and not through regular political channels, even if it's a last minute pardon on the way out. Although I'll hold out some hope for it.
Yeah, it would be nice if somebody could get to him and say, you know, it would really piss these maniacs off, the ones that stole the election from you, the ones that put you through hell for the last 4 years. You know, they're so involved. They're never going to let this guy out of prison. They're going to hang him. They're going to drag him back here, do a show trial, and, you know, whatever. That could be a good way. I mean, he seems like the type of guy that would be petty enough to want to take a good shot at those people. And look, I would be petty enough to take a shot at those people too, because they deserve a shot to be taken at them. And to allow to do that and say, I'm going to pardon Julian Assange and maybe Snowden and, maybe Ross Ulbricht and for his role in Silk Road, if he even knows about Ross,
get Reality Winner out of there while you're at it too.
Yeah. Let's make a list. Here are all the things that you can do to make the other side really go crazy, and they couldn't do anything about it if you were to do it as president. Boom, boom, boom. Make it like the 12 days of Christmas. Every day for 12 days, you drop another person just got out of prison. This guy got out, and then you watch him just freak. Where do things stand with the Assange case? Where we watched. I don't know if everybody in the United States was as, let me rephrase that. Not everybody in the United States was as plugged in as you guys were on this, but there's casual interest in it. But what is the deeper interest? Like, what was going on the last couple of weeks in the UK with this trial?
So, September 7th started the final phase of Julian Assange's extradition, or as we were calling it and still call it, a rendition hearing. Yeah. Because it's not an extradition, because it's a broad daylight fucking kidnapping of a journalist and publisher for printing facts about the US government. Right. So there were 4 total weeks of witness statements and testimony. We learned an awful lot throughout that process. And I checked, we did something like 70 hours of coverage over that month. It was ridiculous. But nobody was covering the hearing as it was taking place, except for the people who were live tweeting. And that's because it was a closed hearing. If you were a credentialed journalist, you could apply for a spot so that you could watch the proceedings on a cloud video platform. Way too few journalists did that. Way too few. And you couldn't, it's not like you could share screen with somebody so they could watch the hearing, because if you got caught, it was 5 years in prison in the UK for sharing that feed. Action for Assange, the organization that I'm a national organizer for, and we do the Free Assange Vigil series, and have been able to crowdfund and put on several weeks worth of demonstrations in Washington, D.C. and other places. We got up at, my dumbass got up at 2 o'clock in the morning, It's 5 o'clock in the morning on the East Coast. And we sat here in front of a camera for the duration of the hearing for the day and broke down what was happening and analyzed it based off of the live tweets and the fact that we had a couple of those reporters who would pop into the stream with us and let us know what was going on. Long story short, the prosecution started out this hearing in September saying, it's okay if we extradite Julian Assange and torture him to death for 175 years because he's not a real journalist. And after several days of testimony proving beyond a shadow of a doubt that, yes, WikiLeaks is a journalistic outlet, Julian Assange engaged in journalistic activities, the prosecution changed their argument to, well, we can prosecute and extradite any journalist or publisher that we want. And they said the quiet part out loud there. And the woman, Claire Dobbin, who was working for the prosecution, you know, was yanked and wasn't allowed a day in court for about another week because she said the quiet part out loud. So then they changed their tactic to, okay, well, look, it's not about whether or not he's a real journalist or a publisher. He had a conversation with Chelsea Manning where they talked about the eventual possible maybe need to hack into the systems that she was working on. And that's what we're concerned about. And that is the only reason we're prosecuting him. And then they had someone who had testified at Chelsea Manning's court martial who got put on the witness stand. And he said, Chelsea Manning didn't need a username or password to access any of the information that she then allegedly gave to Julian Assange.
Didn't need it.
Did not need a username or password for Cablegate, for the Iraq war logs, for the Afghan war logs, for collateral murder. It was just on the system and accessible for up to 100,000 people at Manning's rank alone.
Which was it? What was his rank at the time? Low, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Very.
Whoa.
Like staff sergeant or something like that.
Okay,
like, so, not a high rank.
So anybody could have accessed this.
Anyone at her level or above could have accessed it. No password, no username required. So that came out. So they changed their argument to, well, okay, but people were hurt as a result of this. And then they had several days of testimony where it was proven in court that beyond a shadow of a doubt, no harm had come to anyone as a result of a WikiLeaks release. There was one person who they tried to say was harmed by this. That got shot down and blew out of the water. So they jumped to another tactic, which was, we really don't like this guy and we would like to torture him for 175 years. So if you could just give him to us so we could continue torturing him to death, that would be fantastic. And that's about where they left it. The last day of the hearing, they had the former co-founder and a former employee from UC Global, the Spanish security firm that we now know was contracted by the CIA through Sheldon Adelson to spy on Julian Assange, to plot his murder, that came out, to possibly kidnap him, that came out, all at the behest of Trump's largest and most influential donor and the Central Intelligence Agency. And yet, the U.S. maintains that this is not a political prosecution. And how they can do that with a straight face, Charlie, I have no idea.
Well, Shelly Adelson is like a straight up mobster. I mean, I lived in Vegas for 10 years. That guy's running a faction of the Jewish mafia. This is undeniable.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about in the British court, you're going to expose a murder for hire plot. And that isn't going to trigger anything, but the guy that accessed information that was on a computer that he didn't need a username or password for, that guy you got a problem with, and the person that he gave that information to, you've got a big problem with. but you don't have a problem with the plotting of the murder of a journalist in an embassy on UK soil, you would think that there
would be some Ecuadorian sort of, soil, but yeah.
Oh, Ecuadorian soil. Yeah. I guess, yeah, technically, yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Oh, and there's a little bit more to that, too. There is. The case against UC Global is still ongoing in Spain. Julian may actually testify in that. A number of people have testified in that. And what we have found out is that David Morales, the guy who owned the company, was specifically told by Adelson's head of security, who was their cutout, their go-between for all of this, to, quote, get as much information as possible on tape of Julian's meetings with his legal team. Like, flat out, go ahead and shit all over lawyer-client confidentiality. That's a quaint notion that some people think they have, but this doesn't apply here. So, from 2017 until April 11th, 2019, every single meeting that Assange took with his lawyers was not only taped, it was filmed, in some cases live streamed, and given to the Central Intelligence Agency.
Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah.
This
and,
is-
and again, this came out in court. And yet still, there was no... Daniel Ellsberg has made this point. He said, this is what got my case thrown out. This is why I wasn't prosecuted under the Espionage Act, was because the Nixon administration ordered that my psychiatrist's office be broken into so that they could go through his files, so they could dig up dirt on me, and that was enough for the judge to toss Ellsberg's case. In this circumstance, we have Vanessa Bereitzer, concierge for the U.S. State Department, who is a magistrate under a woman named Lady Arbuthnot, whose husband, Lord Arbuthnot, is mentioned in WikiLeaks because he's a defense contractor. So this woman's husband and son have both been exposed to WikiLeaks. She is the head magistrate overseeing the case, and the other judges who may be in on it has not recused herself for conflict of interest and, in fact, just got a promotion.
Here's the important question. Do the women in the UK courts have to wear the powdered wigs too?
You know, I honestly don't know.
I don't know.
I wish I did. We didn't have the cloud video platform, so we couldn't look into the courtroom. And it made me realize, Charlie, like, I never really understood America's collective obsession with following court proceedings or trials. You know, like, I remember OJ, but I wasn't glued to the television.
No.
You know, but I know a ton of people that were. And after living and breathing this hearing for a month straight, like literally a month straight, I do kind of understand our collective, obsession with following court proceedings, because that shit was beyond fascinating. In the first place, in a U.S. courtroom, we never would have heard a word about U.S. war crimes or about torture or about abuse of rank, position, or authority, because that testimony would have been immediately barred. Which that will happen if Julian Assange is renditioned here, because it's a national security case. Yeah. And because it's a national security case, because it's an Espionage Act case, there is no public defense, public interest defense. Julian will not be able, and his legal team will not be able to say, the public had a right to know what the United States government was doing with its sons, daughters, and fortune. That's against the law, against court law, to talk about what you did as something that needed to happen in terms of the public interest.
Do you think the U.S. government, if that case moves back here, will just put so much pressure on Assange's defense team that they don't give him the sort of defense that he deserves? Like, if I was a defense attorney representing Julian Assange, knowing what I know about the way the behavior of the intelligence agencies in this country, I don't think I would be starting my car in my garage every morning. I think I'd be worried that I'd pull a Sam Rothstein and blow myself.
Yeah.
Like this is already an unfair, an unlevel playing field for a variety of reasons. But then when you factor in the implied possibility of death to everybody on that side, you know, be it the defense attorneys or the defendant himself. I mean, where do we even begin with something like this? Do you think he's going to be extradited back or renditioned back to the U.S.?
You know what? I'm an activist for Julian Assange. I have to maintain a little like core of hope.
Yeah.
Right? Otherwise, I'm a liability to the people around me, mm-hmm. you know, and my activism falters. I think it'll be much harder to stop now that we know that from January 4th, when Baratzer reads her decision, January 4th of 2021, until like April or May. That's the now projected length of time of the appeals process. We had originally thought it was going to be a year, 2 years, maybe even 5 years for the appeal process. But his partner, Stella Morris, and Christian Ramson, the current editor-in-chief at WikiLeaks, are talking about this may be settled in a matter of months. And if it's settled in a matter of months, that in my mind, more or less guarantees extradition. Mm-hmm. I want to be wrong about that. I would like it to be a short appeals process because it is glaringly obvious of the political nature of this prosecution, the amount of human rights, civil liberties, and UK laws, US laws, Ecuadorian laws, Swedish laws, have all been violated in the process of this. International law has been violated in the process of this. There, no legitimate courtroom would rule for extradition in this, but we live in a fucking cartoon and right. Actual kangaroos would be more fair and impartial behind the bench here. Yeah. Than the team that the UK has put together for it. So as much as I don't want it to happen, it will likely happen, and I want very badly to be wrong about that.
Well, where do things stand with Chelsea Manning though? Now
she's free
out for after the second time around,
almost 270 days. Well, okay, maybe. Maybe it'll be a lot harder to put her behind bars again because the entire reason that she was locked up was for refusing to testify in the grand jury, the WikiLeaks grand jury that was secret until WikiLeaks exposed it because someone gave them some leaked material and it proved the existence of a secret WikiLeaks grand jury. So she was locked up each time. After her initial sentence for what she was court-martialed for refusing to testify in this grand jury. Jeremy Hammond, same thing. He got dragged from Oklahoma to the Alexandria Detention Center because he wouldn't testify in this grand jury. They dismissed that in March of this year. Grand jury no longer impaneled. So Chelsea Manning was no longer in violation of anything because the grand jury didn't exist anymore. So she was released. It's possible, but not likely, that they can impanel a new grand jury and demand her testimony and she can refuse and she'll get locked up again. However,
does it max out at 270 days? Is that there's no maximum. I thought there was a time limit on the grand jury testimony or something.
Maybe.
Yeah. I don't know.
We just keep a running count when we do the Assange vigils. Every time that we start, we tell you how many days Julian Assange has spent in illegal and arbitrary detention.
How many days is that?
It's almost 3,700. I can.
God damn!
Tell you here in a moment. I'll pull up from Wednesday. The UN Working Group on Arbitrary Detention found that his time in the embassy was indeed a form of arbitrary detention because he couldn't leave, because he couldn't even go see a doctor. Had he stepped foot outside that building, he would have been swarmed and again dragged to Belmarsh Prison, the Guantanamo Bay of the United Kingdom, where he is right now.
I always thought that they should have, when he was in the Ecuadorian embassy, they should have held a Julian Assange lookalike contest in the lobby there and get like 50 guys that looked exactly like him, mix him in there, and then open the back door and send everybody out in different directions running. I figure they, you know, the real one might have gotten away.
That's funny. So it's 3,621 days.
Oh my God.
Of illegal and arbitrary detention, 575 days since he was illegally removed from the Ecuadorian embassy after the Ecuadorian government under Lenin Moreno sold him to the United States for a $4.2 billion IMF loan.
Yeah, they did. They sold his ass. I mean, talk about, you hear that term that you got sold out. He literally got sold out. Yeah. IMF is dirty. They're dirty motherfuckers, I'll tell you. Well, speaking of the IMF, that kind of, we can kind of transition into the next thing, and that is the World Economic Forum and their relationship with these, you know, bankers and IMF, World Bank, and what they're trying to. I just recorded an episode. It's going to go out. I like to kind of take a week. I do two episodes of this show. I do one which is an interview and one that's a monologue. And my monologue for the week that I put this interview out is going to be about the Great Reset and the World Economic Forum. So I wanted to kind of marry these two together. And nice. You've done extensive work on that. This is one of these this is one of these situations that the vast majority of people don't really know a whole lot about. And then if they do know about it, they've heard about it on their nightly news, or maybe they saw some video that was on Twitter. It looked like kind of like an ad, and it's talking about this Great Reset. And isn't this wonderful? All these people living in harmony, and look how happy they look, and they're smiling, and when they have clean air, and they're all healthy, and they've got this Great Reset. And you can just smell the Madison Avenue all over this campaign. What the fuck is it? And why should we be very scared about what's going on?
The simplest way that I can put it, Charlie, is that a lot of the same people who are responsible for destroying the planet want to hijack what's left of it and ransom some of it back to us. What they're talking about is the complete financialization of nature. It's incredibly extensive, and really, for the people who are going to be listening to this, I highly recommend that you go and read The Manufacturing of Greta Thunberg for Consent and everything else that Corey Morningstar has written. In fact, Ship Whitney Webb got her on Unlimited Hangout, and there is now a podcast up on Rockfin with Whitney and Corey, and they're it's like titled Demystifying the Great Reset or something like that. I haven't been able to listen to it yet, but I'm definitely looking forward to it. There's a guy who is the CEO of the World Economic Forum. His name's Klaus Schwab, and Schwab has been pushing for this Great Reset now for about 3 years hardcore. And the reason that it sounds so Madison Avenue-y is because it is. It is a marketing ploy leveraged by what Corey refers to as the nonprofit industrial complex, which I agree with that assessment. But it's NGOs and nonprofits who on the surface look like they are pro-environment, pro-sustainability, Sunrise Movement, Extinction Rebellion, was it 530.org, Naomi Klein's institution. And what they actually do is create legislation, at least in the case of 530 and a number of the European ones, that is all in the name of saving the planet, but it is all end user punishing. All of, you know, cap and trade, carbon tax, this, that, and the other. And it rolls back down onto the little guy. Corporations are under no obligation whatsoever to adhere to any sort of sustainability rules, although they're going to start being awarded government contracts. This is one of the things that a Biden-Harris administration promises is the ushering in of this great reset and of the four, they call it the fourth industrial revolution, which again, that's the complete financialization of nature. There's so much involved in it. There really is. I'm going to try and not get lost. If you have any specific questions, I might be able to field those better. Otherwise, it's just there's so many different moving parts to this.
Let's focus on the part that I didn't get too far into in my monologue episode, which is the carbon tax, cap and trade component of this. That where they, you know, like you said, punish the end user for their carbon output, take these carbon offsets that companies are allowed to have, package them up on Wall Street, allow you to sell your, you know, the what's left. If you didn't use all of your allotted amount of carbon output, you can then take that excess part and either roll it over and use it next year, or you can put it on, you can take it to Wall Street and sell it. And I thought, God damn, what an evil genius thing to do, where you invent something out of thin air like the government does, like an allowance, like a cap on what you can pollute, let's say, in carbon. And then anything above that, you get taxed on it. And then they take that allotment and use that as, and they let Wall Street run it and say, well, you guys manage this whole thing. Like, we'll let you kind of run this this marketplace for carbon offsets and carbon credits and things like that. yeah, let's let Goldman Sachs be in charge of this, because they haven't been busted rigging LIBOR, Forex, COMEX, Silver Spoofing, Gold Spoofing. I mean, they're trustworthy, right? They're not going to fuck this whole thing up. So talk about that whole, the cap and trade component of it, like how that is going to be, where you mentioned that the corporations would get wouldn't be involved in this. I think the way I put it in my first or second book was that it would be like you could get a waiver if you were ExxonMobil or something, you know, or if you were any company, you theoretically could get a waiver. But the only ones that are going to get the waivers are the companies that are tied in with the government, like ExxonMobil. And of course, they're the ones polluting the most. The U.S. military is polluting the most, but they're clearly not going to get a cap put on them. So really, what it boils down to is a tax on us, a carbon tax on us, that will be used to fund the New World Order, which is fucking wonderful, I guess. And then on top of that, there's a component of it that gives Wall Street a brand new casino game to rig. Is that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So a lot of this, at least here in the States, not necessarily so in Europe. And by the way, Europe is where most of this is coming out of. Western Europe, that's where most of the NGOs responsible for this are located. But we're not going to be left out. And one of the ways that we're at least here in the States, this is going to be implemented, at least originally, and they may return to that, is the Green New Deal. That was so popularized by AOC, And fucking, I think even Bernie Sanders talked it up quite a bit too. I just certainly like Rose Twitter and the progressives online were screaming about the Green New Deal. Like it was a must pass, which just goes to show you that they haven't read it. There's a phrase that's tossed about in the Green New Deal a lot called labor market flexibility. And basically what that means is I'll read Whitney's quote on it. The term labor market flexibility is a neoliberal buzzword that disguises a corporation's ability to hire and fire at will as an exercise in flexibility as opposed to an exercise of corporate power. A flexible labor market is one where firms are under fewer regulations regarding the labor force and can therefore set wages and fire employees at will. Let's see, where'd that go? Basically uses it to incorporate and roll out a universal basic income. So the argument is going to be, because of the carbon footprint that humans have, it is no longer environmentally safe for them to travel, clog up freeways, and come somewhere to work. So we're going to eliminate those jobs. We're just going to eliminate them. We're not going to try and telecommute or anything like that. We're pushing for an automated society here. That's also part of what the Great Reset is. It's a huge ushering in of, as Jason Burmes likes to call it, the automation nation. So you're going to have a very significant portion of the population that is still obligated to pay taxes, especially the ones that deal with the environment. But because they don't have a job, it's universal basic income to the rescue. Mm-hmm. UBI essentially would be rolled out in conjunction with this as a way for the individual to offset the expenditure of them being alive. It sounds fucking
just
dumb.
Or they could just work.
Or you could just work. But again, there it's going to be billed as it's no longer environmentally sound for you to travel to work. We can't get all of these factories here. Maybe they're not the best. We've got to find a way to do this more efficiently with the highest possible production in mind. So we need to automate. And if we automate, then sure, maybe we'll be polluting, but we're exempt. You guys that used to work, you just hang out. And you stay on your device, and we'll tell you what to think. And when it's time for you to pay your carbon taxes, you'll have a portion of your UBI that you've set aside in order to pay your carbon taxes.
Wow.
Like, it's fucking frightening, man.
Yeah. And, all under the guise of saving the planet, but there's no planet saving going on here. This is, because the polluters will still be polluting. I mean, I wondered about this early when we're going through this 2020 where people were, businesses were shut down and everyone was working from home and they were discovering, hey, I can actually work from home. I don't maybe have to go into the office as much. And we kind of all feel that paradigm shift happening where working from home has become, it had been an option for some people in some industries and obviously some you can never do it. But for anyone that could have maybe sort of done it, it seems like now businesses have no choice but to embrace it. And it made me think that was sort of like the first step towards the automation process where it was like, well, first of all, we're going to just close office buildings in general. We'll get rid of them. And so you don't have to commute anymore. And then eventually it'll be, well, AI can do what you do because it's smarter than you. You're a big dummy sitting there on your cell phone watching TikTok videos and huffing paint and shit. So we're going to have AI replace you. And now we'll put you on a UBI just because the robots took your job. And then that UBI would be tied into like a social credit system. Whereas
100%.
If you're not complying. If you're not getting your mandatory vaccine, you're not getting your UBI. It's kind of like EBT cards now, where it's like, you know, if you don't fill out all the right forms and you don't have your, or you don't pretend to look for a job this week, then you don't get your EBT card refilled. And I could see the same thing being used with a UBI component, where they say, well, we've got free money for you. I mean, we're trying to give you free money, but you're just not, you're not qualifying for it. And well, what do I have to do to qualify? Well, you have to get the vaccine. You have to live in this smart city. You mm-hmm. can't own a car. You can't own anything, really. And I could see the, I could see it just be, you know, a way to it, initially the carrot, you know, to lure people in, and then the stick being, mm-hmm. you know, to beat them over the head with, like, you're never getting out of this. And of course, welfare, as we see, like, conceptually, great idea. Help the needy, help the poor when they need it. But we see what happens is that people get conditioned to live on welfare. They figure out how to navigate a life on just welfare, and then they don't want to get off of it, because if they get off of it, they go down to $0 and all this uncertainty. And if they get a job, maybe that job, it doesn't pay as much as the welfare. So it's like, you can condition people to live off of welfare if you wanted to, a certain percentage. And I think that the same will be for UBI. It'll be like, you want this free money? We're trying to give it to you, man, but you have to comply. And what that, the hoops you have to jump through, would just be the sort of globalist things that they want you, you know, all caught
and,
up.
And don't even think about trying to duck it, and don't even think about trying to cheat it, because we've got you monitored.
Oh,
we
yeah.
know. We know if you're jumping through the right hoops or not. Kamala Harris, on the campaign trail for the couple of months that she was an active presidential candidate, put forth the notion that UBI should be a thing, and that it should be paid through United States owned and operated crypto.
Yeah. Federal Reserve
so
coins.
So you're eliminating cash from society.
Yes. Which they want to do.
And putting it all up on a U.S. government monitored blockchain.
What could possibly go wrong?
This is why I shake my head when some of my more like lefty friends talk about voting on a blockchain. And like, oh, well, there's no way that you can cheat that way. Bullshit. Talk to anyone who's ever fucking coded in their life. You can cheat on that. I just goes to, but I've got some of my very good friends are election integrity activists, and they are so fucking lonely, Charlie. They're so lonely. Like, the only people that are collectively hated more than election integrity activists are Assange activists. It's yeah. just, so we get along great, but no, the UBI thing has bugged me from day one of when I really first started to look into it. I'd kind of heard about it in the earlier, like 2010, 2012, something like that. Mm-hmm. Didn't really give it much thought. And as 2015, 2016 really got rolling, and UBI kept being one of those things that came up in a number of different circles, I looked into it and I was like, well, this is going to completely eliminate the rest of the social safety net. This is going to tether people in ways that we can't even imagine yet. And it's going to come at the cost of a cashless society, which is definitely not something that I'm in favor of.
No,
In fact, I need to call somebody up who's a UBI advocate and see if he wants to do a little on camera debate about it.
Yeah,
I'd love to do that.
It's a fascinating topic, because on the one hand, the way they frame it is, you know, we're just trying to help you out so that everybody's got, you know, the basic, the bare necessities. And but and you go, okay, that sounds okay, that sounds good. And then you go, well, wait, who's offering this again? Oh, it's the U.S. government. You're like, oh, fuck that. I'm not interested in that. Whatever they're selling, I'm not buying, you know, because it, how many examples of this do we need? Hey, let's ask the Native Americans how it worked out when you just rely on the federal government for everything that you need. Let's see how are you guys doing? How's your reservation working out for you? Pretty shitty, I would suggest. So the U.S. government, you know, the only thing worse than their ideas or, you know, I mean, their the problems that they create are the solutions that they create to solve these problems. And UBI sounds like another one of them. And it feels like a trap to me, which of course it is. And as they say, the reason why mice get caught in the mousetrap is they don't understand why the cheese is free. And I think a lot of the people in the United States don't understand why this cheese is free. So they go walk in and grab it and then they gotcha. So between the fuckery with Assange, the craziness of the elections, the upcoming green, you know, the great reset and everything. I mean, it seems like we are in an unbalanced world where the maniacs are running things. The vast majority of the population have been properly dumbed down to the point where they are incapable of using critical thinking to analyze any of these concepts that are coming their way. They're just cheerleading the establishment, clapping like a bunch of, hey, clap for the NHS workers out there, clap at 8 o'clock for the NHS. And then they go out there and clap like a bunch of SEALs. I mean, we got to take some responsibility for ourselves, do we not? I mean, this world that we're living in, it seems like we've been so dumbed down, and I have got plenty of problems with these globalist maniacs, but boy, I still save some of my contempt for the rest of us, for the population, because we have just really outsourced our critical thinking to the media and the government and all these people, the worst people in the world, the religion, you know, our preachers and things like that. We've just said, oh, think for us, because I tried it once and it's so hard, you know. I heard
it's bad for the hair.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, there you go. I was thinking and it all fell out. Oh, man. So where do we go from here? Let's end this on an optimistic note, shall we?
So Julian Assange at the closing to the foreword for Cypherpunks says, our task is to secure self-determination where we can, to hold back the coming dystopia where we cannot, and if all else fails, to assure its self-destruction. We are right at that point where those of us who have been holding back the coming dystopia as much as humanly possible are about ready to snap. Yeah. So what I tell people, and what I've been telling people for years and years and years, is we do have an opportunity to make our communities as sustainable as possible with as little reliance on the federal government or a faceless, soulless corporation as possible. This can be achieved, but what needs to happen is we have to stop playing into the hate thy neighbor dynamic. Mm. We have to recognize, if for the first time ever, recognizing our neighbors as fellow human beings, as people who at least deserve the opportunity to earn our respect, and we deserve the opportunity to earn their respect. But we have to be fucking grown-ups about it. And we can't let a cynical, disingenuous fucking fourth branch of the government in the media to dictate who we like and who we don't like, and how we're allowed to like them and how we're not allowed to like them. There are people walking around right now, Charlie, that have in their brain have no problem recognizing 70 different genders, but they still think binary in terms of politics.
Good point.
And that's like, if you got a brain up there that's expansive enough to be like, okay, well, yeah, there might be 72 different kinds of people in terms of what their gender is, but you can't figure out there's more to life than Republican versus Democrat, then at that point you have chosen to delude yourself. I'm going to guess on multiple levels there. You've chosen to delude yourself. But we got to start talking to each other again. We do. That's one of the things that I hate so much about this COVID 1984 shit, is that it limited our ability to interact with each other in person. And in person is where we make the biggest differences. And having a conversation one-on-one like we are now is fantastic. It is. And I think that more people need to do stuff like this, where you have, you know, not necessarily have a show, because I don't want the competition. I'm kidding. Right. That's a joke. Yeah. I don't fucking. But, you know, having conversations to get the ball rolling, and then take what, you know, what you enjoyed from this, and go physically talk to somebody else about it. Because I didn't. Sammy says it all the time. We're more alike than we are different. I have much more in common with some schlub who just voted for Joe Biden or Donald Trump than I ever will Joe Biden or Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't think for a moment that anyone looked at Joe Biden and Donald Trump and went, this is the best our country can do.
No, certainly. You know? Nobody thought that.
So we know inherently we do. I think a vast majority of the populace knows that something's wrong, isn't sure how to talk about it, but wants to help make it right in some, to the best of their ability. So that's what we have to do. We have to go and we have to talk to people, and we have to figure out how we can write this without their help to the best of our ability, which I'm sure sounds a little Marxian, but it's not.
No, I think it's the good first step to have these conversations. Steve, where can people find you? Where can people find your work? Where can people find your show? Where can people stalk you?
So, if you really want to stalk me, you can move to the Santa Cruz Mountains. If you're a little lazier about it, I am on Twitter at Slow News Day Show. I finally, on election day, deleted my Facebook, and I feel like 40 pounds lighter. Oh my God, it was so nice. So nice. Just this instant, like, oh God, that felt good. So at Slow News Day Show on Twitter, I'm probably going to start being more active on Minds. I'm on Minds as Steve Poikkanen. Let's see, the show. I'm trying to get people to watch it on the Rockfin, man. The Rockfin is a fantastic platform. It's like the anti-YouTube. They started it with us as content creators in mind. There's no censorship. It pays in cryptocurrency. You can get a free account. You can't watch everyone's premium content that way, but you can watch everyone's free content that way. Should you choose to endorse Slow News Day, for example, it's $10 a month, and you get access to everybody's premium content. So unlike Patreon, where you have to dish, you know, $5 here, $10 there, $10 there, to each content creator, it's, you know, you pay once a month and you get everybody's free shit. I'm also on Odyssey, which is Library's new streaming platform. I'm on YouTube. If you type in Slow News Day podcast into the YouTube search bar, I should pop up. I'm suppressed like a motherfucker over there. I'm amazed. Good. I still have right. a channel. Like, I'm amazed I still have a channel. On election day, Jason Burmess and Whitney Webb and I fucking just went at it for like 2 hours, and it was brutal and fantastic. Yeah. But we didn't stream it to YouTube immediately. We all uploaded it after the fact, and that might have taken a little bit of the sting out. I'm on DLive. And I see Action for Assange. You can go to actionforassange.com and find everything that we're up to, all of our shows, all of the platforms we're on. And hopefully tonight, Sleepy Josh just sent me a message saying, okay, I think we should be able to launch tonight. SlowNewsDayShow.com will have the entire archive of everything we've done over the last 2 years. It will have video and audio only formats. We are going to, like, I'm occasionally going to write for it. I once upon a time, Charlie, I don't even know if you know this, I used to write for The Nation.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
I was part of The Nation's 2008 blog team, and I got fired from The Nation because I wrote and tried to publish an article called Barack Obama, Reagan with a Tan.
They didn't like that?
No, technically I was fired by Chris Hayes because he was still the politics editor at The Nation at the time. But so I'm gonna start writing again. Caitlin Johnstone says you can republish any of her stuff. So we'll be another place where you can catch up with Caitlin Johnstone's work. Ray McGovern has given me permission to reprint anything he writes. There's a couple of other journalists out there that have said the same thing, but I'm trying to keep that shit under my hat so you can be pleasantly surprised when you go to slownewsdayshow.com, which should hopefully, again, as of November 6th, be live by like midnight tonight. So by the time this airs, it'll be up and running.
That's great. Hey, everybody, go support Steve's work. Share this video. God knows the algorithms won't do it. They hate us. They hate my guts. They hate Steve's guts even more, I'm sure.
So bad.
So
I watch my view counts roll backwards.
Right. Yeah, they're rolling back Steve's odometer over at YouTube, but the rest of us can do what we can to share the word. So thanks, everybody. Take care. Steve, thanks. You're the best.
Thank you, man. I appreciate it.